still buying your coffee at the grocery store and settling for coffee that may have been roasted months before it got to you? Why? When you could be drinking coffee that makes you shiver with anticipation. Give in to temptation and make the switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and your next new favorite. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to your home or office or castle within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries and never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's just a jump to your left and a click away from the best coffee you've ever had. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi, time-warping film devotees, and thank you for devouring our jibber-jab about classic movies. If our previous podcasts about the AFI's great movies from the 1998 and 2007 100 Years, 100 Movies lists interest you, you can find them all online and it'll cost you nothing. Those episodes were laced with poisonous spoilers, and this one will be too. I'm the sweet heterosexual from Torontovania, Ryan Ellis, and here's my perfect creation, my wife, the Bevy Horror Podcast Show.
That's me.
Did they ever call him Rocky Horror in this movie?
No, they only ever call him Rocky, I think.
I think they did call him Rocky Horror.
They just throw horror in there.
We mentioned this last week, building up to this podcast, that I have not seen this movie in well over 20 years, and I'm not sure you're that well-versed in it either, so we're a little bit, essentially, newcomers to it all over again.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it in just about 20 years either.
I'm sure that won't be my first question I'll ask you about what's going on here. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the ultimate cult movie. In which project is Tim Curry most terrifying? The Butler in Clue? The Concierge in Home Alone 2, The Evil Clown in It, the TV series, of course, not the more recent movies, or Dr. Frankenfurter in Rocky Horror.
So I'm going to go rogue. Rooster Hannigan in Annie, because I saw Annie infinity times when I was a kid, and he totally scared me at the end when him and Bernadette Peters are chasing Annie up the big ladder and they want her to fall to her death. I was scared of him.
Oh, I didn't know he was in that. I haven't seen Annie, the original one, in a long time.
Guess you weren't a little girl in the 80s, were you?
I don't think so.
Well, this is a pretty gender-bending podcast, you may have been.
My answer for this question, and of course it is an opinion, would be It, the TV series. Although Bill Skarsgård, kudos to him for playing the clown so well in the more recent movies. I say movies because, of course, there's one coming out this year, the sequel to the huge hit from a couple years ago. But he was great as Pennywise in the TV series, miniseries, I guess it was. But Tim Curry, always.
You know, I never saw It, the TV series, because obviously if I was a kid that found Annie scary, I wasn't allowed to watch scary movies when I was a kid. As much as I love being scared now, as a little girl, my parents wouldn't let me anywhere near anything like that.
It's not so much terrifying in this. I have not seen Clue in a long time. I just looked for his red letter performances, and that stood out. But Home Alone 2, the small part of the movie he plays there, although people have pointed out online that he's not wrong to be trying to go after a kid who's in a hotel by himself, a luxury hotel as it turns out, and Donald Trump's hotel, God, as it turns out. But anyway, they do show him with a smile. He has a great smile that looks so much like the Grinch, because I think that plays, and then they cut to him. It's a really great edit. So I'll go with It, but meh, Tim Curry all the time. Okay, Rocky Horror was absolutely, positively nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. It was released by 20th Century Fox. Oh, Fox, our poor little dog. In London, in August 1975. Then it slowly unrolled in America later that year. And it was a gigantic mega hit. Although I was reading online, it wasn't a hit at first. It was a slow builder. The big thing with this movie is the midnight screenings. I think it still shows everywhere. It's one of those movies that never really stopped playing. Name even five others that's true about. Some of the biggest hits ever, Gone with the Wind, Star Wars, Sound of Music, Jaws, the same year as Rocky Horror. they've made so much money, but do they play for decades without interruption?
Consistently. Many cities have a weekly screening.
Mm. And I was reading also that they bring props, like they do for The Room. That's a bad movie where they bring props and they throw them at the screen or just waggle them around or what have you. And I heard they do the same thing for Rocky Horror. Okay, Bev, remind me and everyone else what this movie's about with the Rocky Horror Picture Show's G'day!
Tim Curry is extraterrestrial mad scientist transvestite Dr. Frankenfurter, who's about to unveil his latest scientific triumph when his party is interrupted by a couple of squares, Brad and Janet, who happened to get a flat outside his castle. But no worry, he draws them into his bizarre world of indulgent chaos, and before the night is over, Brad and Janet have been initiated into all kinds of perversions, cannibalism, and time warping.
Let's do the time warp again. That's not a song I can sing well at all. Or, in a nutshell, if someone asks you if Susan Sarandon and Meatloaf were ever in a Frankenstein adaptation, you say, yes! Because this movie is as much Frankenstein as it is, apparently supposed to be, a very dark, pitch black Wizard of Oz. And I've been reading a lot lately that filmmakers base a lot of the things on Wizard of Oz. David Lynch especially has said that. And if they think this movie's Wizard of Oz, fine. But this movie is very much, more so I think in fact, a Frankenstein movie. Right down to him being called Frankenfurter, not yeah. Frankenstein.
Richard O'Brien, I saw an interview with him where he said that his two main inspirations were none of those things. But one was Adam and Eve. He thinks that Brad and Shannon are Adam and Eve and that Frankenfurter is the serpent. The other thing he said was Hansel and Gretel. Those were the two main influences. But obviously his main influences were all the monster movies of the classic era. He was a huge fan of B-movies, science fiction, and horror that were nonsense and had cheap props and had plots that didn't make any sense. And
that applies here.
Yeah, and this is very much a satire of those films, along with a million other things, of course.
There's a lot of references to classic films in this, right down to the very end, where it's very blatant that they're showing RKO kind of things. King Kong is referenced for sure in the very end of the film.
Well, the very first song, Science Fiction Double Feature, which is just the lips singing name drops, a dozen or more classic science fiction horror films. So he makes his case right there. Apparently they use props from some old sequel of Frankenstein as well. The body chamber that Rocky is birthed in is, and the dummy itself are from some production of a Frankenstein sequel.
Frankenstein movies were made into the 70s. I bought a really cheap DVD, looked terrible, but all kinds of really crappy horror films. It cost me something like $10, and I think I got 60 movies or 30 movies or something like that.
You know they're good.
But a lot of them were things like, I can't even think of a title, it'd be The Necklace of the Brother of the Daughter of Frankenstein or something really bad like that. That's not a real title. Okay, so let's get through some numbers in Rocky Horror. 80% of critics like this film, 33 fresh, 8 rotten, for an average of 6.5 out of 10, which is not too bad, and 85% of audiences. As far as box office, it was number 2 in 1975, behind Jaws, which I mentioned before. And also that means, of course, it was ahead of blockbusters and very renowned films, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which won the Oscars, Best Picture and whatnot, and Dog Day Afternoon. We've covered all those movies, Jaws, Cuckoo's Nest, and Dog Day, long ago.
Did it make all that money in 1975, though, or is that like a cumulative?
I think that's cumulative.
Okay.
But it was a big hit in that individual year as well. It currently is 83rd on Box Office Mojo's top 300 adjusted for inflation. 83rd.
That's incredible.
Nearly $500 million adjusted, which is thousands of dollars, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars ahead of Rocky. So it goes Rocky Horror Picture Show, Rocky.
Imagine you could break down not just the money it made or the number of tickets it sold, but the number of people who saw the movie, because most of the money it's made has been from the same people going to see it week after week after week.
I don't really fully get why any movie would inspire that, and I'll say Star Wars is included. No movie is worth the devotion that a lot of them get, including, of course, Rocky Horror.
Okay, but you can see how this is an exception compared to Star Wars, because Star Wars was a great movie that was appealing to people across the board, but Rocky Horror's fans always describe the moment they discover the midnight screenings as like an initiation into the tribe where they belong, the culture that they had been missing in their lives, because if you're the type of person who starts going to midnight showings of Rocky Horror on the regular, then you're probably the type of person who struggled to fit into bland, heteronormative American culture. It's like any good tribe. The screenings have uniforms and rituals, and some of the rituals are super strange, and no one necessarily remembers how they even got started, but they all cement this sense of belonging to the participants who feel like they have the pages of the secret script that makes them part of this exclusive and subversive club. And like church, it's once a week. There are these songs and rituals. It gives them all a sense of belonging. And I think it fills something in a way for a group of people that Star Wars can't or does on such a large scale that it doesn't really count in the same way. The people who discover Rocky Horror Picture Show really needed it. It's not like they just loved it. This group needed a positive representation. Positive is a stretch. A lot of people have written a lot of think pieces about whether or not it's positive now in 2019. But I think in 1975, it's fair to say that outside of David Bowie, there was virtually nothing that had this subversive, androgynous, pansexual, open-minded attitude like this.
That's the key word. Curry himself even says that Frankenfurter is not transsexual, he's pansexual, and it's proven by the fact that he sleeps with both Brad and Janet.
And as much as he dresses like a woman with panache, you know, almost this kabuki version of a woman, because it's lingerie and the makeup. And
that's what seems like transsexualism.
Yeah, but then he carries himself not just like a man, but Mick fucking Jagger, you know? He has swagger and he's macho and he doesn't have the slightest bit of femininity in his voice or his gait or anything except, aggressively so, his clothes. He is just this brand new, total self-invention. I think that's what's exciting about it. He doesn't fit any mold. He's completely unique. Apparently Mick Jagger wanted the part. He had seen it. I'm not sure if he saw Tim Curry perform it on stage, but Tim Curry did play Frankenfurter in the London production as well as the Los Angeles production. But Jagger wanted the part when he found out it was going to be made into a movie. Thankfully, they gave it to Tim Curry because I just can't think of a better individual performance.
This was Curry's movie debut, and as they often say about acting, it really applies this time. He went for it. Kudos to that. He doesn't appear, though, until 25 minutes in. That's with a proviso. We'll get into that in 1 second. I was reading that the crazy fans of this movie drove him nuts. It reminds me of Norman Bates on Psycho and other actors who've distanced themselves from very famous roles because they didn't want to be typecast, and then eventually they learned to accept it. Anthony Perkins, I think I said Norman Bates. Anyway, they eventually stopped fighting the fan backlash and got to the point where they, I guess you could argue, loved the role. And they probably did at the time, and then it was the whole sort of, Jesus Christ, it's just a movie role, people. Leave me alone. I don't think that Curry made a movie for a few years. I was looking at his resume, and I seem to remember it was 3 years before he made another movie. Maybe because studios thought, we can't cast this guy. He's gay. Well, they would call him gay. Let's just call a spade a spade.
Even though he's clearly bisexual in the movie. He sleeps with
men
and women.
But that's what Hollywood would have said about the actor. He's gay. A lot of actors are gay. They were then. They are now. But he's out there, so we can't cast him. That is the only explanation I can think of for 3 years between making movies when he made something so iconic and successful, even then, and certainly since.
Well, I have a possible explanation. You said this was his first film. Prior to this, he was a very successful actor.
On stage.
Then. Yeah, when I say he performed this in London, it was to 1,000-seat theater. He had done tons of productions, and he still does to this day. On Broadway, he's played the MC in Cabaret. And he's an excellent stage actor. I mean, look at his presence in this film. You can completely see how he could pull off any of a dozen amazing musical roles. So maybe he just never planned to be a film actor, or maybe it just took Hollywood a little while to cast him and then it takes longer to make films. Nobody knew who he was before this film came out as a screen actor.
It's fair. He probably had work in London and didn't have to worry about doing other things, but I just have a feeling that he was typecast right from the very beginning, and then it took a while for him to get other roles, including a lot of these weird or villainous roles, including in Home Alone 2, where he's not a villain, but he's still weird, in a good way. This is the cultiest of cult films, incidentally, and it was in an era of rock and roll musicals, Hair and Tommy, Jesus Christ Superstar. I don't know if we really said blatantly yet after all this time, did we like this movie? What about you? You're a fan, I guess?
Oh, yeah. I love it. It's funny and campy and irreverent, totally unique, still feels subversive 44 years later. And like I said before, Tim Curry's Dr. Frankenfurter is too good for all of us. And the songs are jams, too. I was singing them all week.
If it weren't for the songs, I wouldn't be a thumb up. I am because of those. I don't think the movie's bad by any means. It certainly isn't my, as you would say, jam. And that's probably not surprising. As the kids would say. I do love a lot of weird movies, though, and I think this one fits that bill. Time Warp is a great tune. It was nominated for the Top 100 Songs. Should have made the Top 100 Songs. Another error in that stupid list, one of the worst AFI lists of all time for some of the omissions. When you talk about iconic songs, I'm not sure it was an original. Probably not. It plays more than once, too, which makes it even more important because it's actually relevant to the plot in the movie, and then it plays, I think, in the end credits as well.
Tell you who is not leaving off their list, and that is straight white people wedding DJs.
Right. Great dance
song.
It's
a huge wedding song. People love to do the dance.
But my problem with the movie is that it doesn't make a ton of sense. Now, the Frankenstein storyline keeps you moored. I know that one very well. It's been adapted in one movie or another many times, including Edward Scissorhands, which we covered a couple years ago. That's also the Frankenstein storyline all over again. But it did seem to have no real direction. And they talk about, and you mentioned this in your skinny a few minutes ago, that they're aliens. And it almost seems like that's just out of nowhere. Let's get back to something I mentioned a few minutes ago. The opening scene after the credits, which are, by the way, dripping blood red. Maybe it's supposed to be smeared lipstick. So it's either blood or lipstick. I like that touch. But right after the credits, we have a wedding. Incidentally, there's no way churches were cool with this movie.
No, you don't think so?
But behind the bride and groom, on the steps of the church, clearly it's Tim Curry, but not dressed up as Frank. And also, of
course, he's the priest.
Yes. And also Richard O'Brien and Patricia Quinn as Riff Raff and Magenta. That's very obvious. And they're American Gothic type getup.
Columbia's in there as well. Maybe not in the first shot, but you see her later on.
Okay, I didn't know to look for her. That's one thing about not knowing this movie. Magenta, Columbia, Riff Raff, those names meant nothing to me. I knew Riff Raff was in this movie, but the other ones I didn't know so much.
Riff Raff, played by Richard O'Brien, who is the creator of Rocky Horror. He wrote...
It was Rocky Horror Show on stage. Maybe it's a bit of a play on Last Picture Show as well.
Maybe.
So it's pretty clearly a setup, and I think you're supposed to realize that because Curry and O'Brien and Quinn are at that wedding. The flat tire, the dead end, the castle that they can only go to for solace in the rain. His lackeys have set this all up. Brad is listening to Nixon Resigning, which was in August. The movie is supposed to be set in November of 1974, and Nixon resigned in August of 74. So you could call it a continuity mistake, but what I read online, and this is fun to me actually, is that Brad would just often listen to Nixon quitting. It's like me watching clips of my favorite movies of the Blue Jays winning those playoff games
the
a couple years
hits.
Ago over and over again because he just got to relive that great moment. Rub it in to Nixon. All right, so our two main actors, well, I guess Tim Curry is top billed. In a way, he's the main actor, but he's not really in the movie as much. Like I said, 25 minutes in. But Susan Sarandon and Barry Bostwick. Now, we've covered Sarandon in Thelma and Louise and Bull Durham, and she won her Oscar from Dead Man Walking. 20 years after this movie, she's had a great career. We all know Susan Sarandon. As for Bostwick, he's been in hundreds of TV shows. He was the mayor on Spin City, maybe his most famous TV show. And in this, he's the perfect American dope. Sarandon and Bostwick do sing their songs. I didn't think they did, but I looked online and it says that they actually are singing.
That's why it sounds so bad.
Well, maybe it's supposed to be, but I do find that the singing by all of them seems like it isn't quite right. In most musicals we've watched, okay, I always say musicals seem fake, even the best ones, and sometimes I can accept that. But this one does seem more than the other ones as if they're not singing live. And the other movies I could have maybe believed they were singing live, and this one is so blatantly obvious. Maybe that's because it's not the most expensive production of all time. And you can infer that that's supposed to be deliberate. But if people were to say that Susan Sarandon didn't sing in the movie, well, we know she sang in this, and she was not great at it. I guess that's maybe the point. They're not supposed to be great singers. So what'd you think of Sarandon and Bostwick?
They're perfectly cast as the guileless, sweet, totally American, engaged couple. So innocent. Go to the castle, and then, of course, be completely corrupted overnight. Apparently, Fox insisted that they had to recast with American actors, and that's how they got the part. And they were dating in real life.
Like, Sarandon and Bostwick were.
Obviously, it didn't last. It was like a really tough shoot, and it was very cold in there, and she got pneumonia. Mm. Although, you can never tell. Doesn't have a great singing voice, but like you said, it kind of works. It makes her seem more shy and frail that she has this tinny singing voice. An alternate title for the film was They Came from Denton. The they being Brad and Janet, implying that these prim, uber-normal couple were the actual monsters of the film, the they.
What a terrible title, though.
Yeah, I mean, Rocky Horror Picture Show, even though it's like a strange, grammatically weird title, it's memorable, stands out, They Came from Denton. I don't know, I don't think it would fit the spirit of the film, truly. Although making Rocky the center of the film is even weirder than making Brad and Janet in the title of the film. Because he's not that significant of a character in the end at all.
It's true. He's the monster in the Frankenstein story. Peter Hinwood plays Rocky. He was a model. He was only in 3 movies and 1 TV miniseries. The guy is perfectly built. He is flawless. The definition of those abs. But I love that when he's born, he can sing immediately. One of the better touches in one of the Frankenstein adaptations is the one with De Niro and Branna, where Branna's got to pick him up. His monster can't walk. But in this Frankenstein adaptation, he is right ready to go in every single way. And if he'd cast a better actor, maybe he would have had a bigger part. I'm not saying I read that he had less of a part because of that, but he's not that much of the movie considering it's named after him.
Mm-hmm.
It really should have been named after Frankenfurter, who has a pink triangle on his scrubs when we first meet him. And I was reading the Nazis used that to indicate gay guys back in the Holocaust times.
It's kind of been re-owned by gay people, particularly lesbians, the pink triangle.
So. Plus, like, reclaiming the N-word for black people.
Maybe.
A big name guy has one small part of this movie, and that is Meatloaf, who comes in, sings one song, then he's killed. Now, we've covered him in Fight Club, where he has a more major role than in this, and a small role in Wayne's World only a few months ago. Of course, he's a big rock star, and he does sing his song very well. He also has love and hate tattoos on his knuckles, which was originally a Night of the Hunter as tattoos, and then Do the Right Thing, Radio Raheem has them on his knuckles, these rings that form these big title cards, almost, love and hate. And I think that Spike Lee wore those at the Oscars this year, didn't he?
Did he?
I think he did.
That's cool. I
have to look back and check that, but I think it's true. But Eddie actually shows that at one point. I don't really get the point of him being in this movie, except he is killed pretty quickly. So not only is Dr. Frank somebody who traps people in his castle, terrorizes them, fucks them both, he also murders somebody.
Yeah.
And then, of course, at the end, he's murdered himself. And that's where you get even more the Frankenstein and monster comparisons. Although in the original movie in 1931, the doctor survives, he shouldn't, and the creature is supposedly killed. The sequels play out that the creature survived too. But both Frank and his creation are dead before the movie is over. In fact, there's quite a bit of time left in the movie, 5 or 10 minutes, something like that. And they're laying in the water, and I hadn't seen the movie in so long, I thought, are they going to come back and be part of this? But no. At the very end, Poltergeist-esque, the heroes get out of the house, the castle, whatever, and then everybody else who's in there, all these aliens, fly off wherever they're going to go, and I guess to the galaxy of Transylvania and the planet Transsexual.
Yeah, that's the part where the plot gives up on making any sense, which O'Brien said was specifically a silly homage to all of the terrible B-movies that he loved, where the scripts were hopelessly bad and nonsensical.
Pucci and Simpsons.
He went back to his home planet. I never could find out the story behind why Meatloaf was in the movie. He probably saw the stage play. It is so on brand for him. The music, the drama, the outfits, the gothicness of it. I bet he just begged his way into the movie and they wrote a song for him because he was a big star. Why not put Meatloaf in your movie?
His credit is Eddie, ex-delivery boy. I guess ex because he's dead.
Although I guess he would have always been a character in the play, wouldn't he? They couldn't have just added him in for the movie because his death is, like, the plot makes sense, but his death is like an inciting incident that it kind of turns Columbia against Frankenfurter, and then they eat him in a cannibalistic dinner.
Well, it's funny because one of the references, and there's a lot of connections to other movies in this one, but one of the ones I wrote down before we even started watching the movie is Tony Rocky Horror in Pulp Fiction. That's a character we never see, but he's mentioned early on and then a little bit later on where Travolta and Sam Jackson talk about how Tony Rocky Horror was thrown through a greenhouse window or something by Ving Rhames' character because he dared to touch Uma Thurman's feet.
Mrs. Mia Wallace.
Right. And Rocky Horror in that movie is implied to be this overweight Samoan, so not a particularly attractive guy. More like Meatloaf. And yet Rocky Horror in this is a blonde god.
Like an Adonis.
Now, Riff Raff has a pretty big role in this film, and that is Richard O'Brien, who I was reading was jealous of Curry, who had better lines and was better looking. But of course he has better lines. He's got the better part. You knew that going
in.
You wrote the damn thing. O'Brien's actually acted more than he's written since this film, including in Flash Gordon and Dark City. So Riff Raff tortures Rocky with fire, and that's where I really picked up on Frankenstein. Not that I didn't already, but that becomes really obvious because Igor does that to the monster in Frankenstein. That's a very important part of that movie. If you ever watch Frankenstein, if you haven't seen it before, you should. We covered it a long time ago. And when Igor does that to the creature, the monster, that is a terrible moment. You can really sympathize, if you couldn't already, with this poor creature that didn't ask to be reborn. Why are you doing this? Just because. In both this movie and in Frankenstein, he's torturing him. For no good reason. His partner in crime, Magenta, is Patricia Quinn, who is in the sequel, Shock Treatment, which was directed by, we haven't mentioned him yet, Jim Sharman. So Quinn was in the sequel, but none of the major players were. Curry wasn't, Sarandon wasn't, Bostwick wasn't. I've never seen Shock Treatment. I think it's on YouTube, and I meant to watch it before we recorded this, but I didn't actually do that. So O'Brien and Quinn have a major part of the movie. The most screen time is probably Sarandon and Bostwick, but O'Brien and Quinn are right behind them. What do you think of their role in this film? Because at the end, they're turncoats. They shoot crappy lasers at Frank and Rocky and murder them.
Well, it's hard for them to stand out next to, of course, Tim Curry, but I always deeply love Patricia Quinn's voice. Her growly singing style, I just think is perfect.
Time Warp, the song, I'd heard so many times since I've seen the movie, but didn't remember who anyone was. Tim Curry's not in the movie yet, so he's not one of the voices, and neither are Sarandon and Bostwick. But O'Brien's one of the main singers in that, and also Charles Gray, the narrator. I didn't know he played Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever, and looking him up, I realized that he was Blofeld. But he's got a big part of that song, and so does Quinn, and so does, what's her name here? Nell Campbell, who is Columbia. She's a groupie. So all those people are part of the Time Warp song. And then also these random people who we see towards the end. Now, that's one thing about the movie that I guess really gets surreal and whatnot, because they're all performing in front of an audience after they've been de-Medusa'd, if you will, the four of them. Rocky, Janet, Brad, and who's the other one?
And Columbia.
Columbia, okay, right. So they're all performing after they've been taken out of their Medusa statue forms. And we see the audience, and then we don't again later on. So were they never real, or were they just aliens, or what's going on there?
It's so irrelevant by then. I guess that's true, okay. He's got the big RKO tower, another homage to the fact that this is all based on horror movies.
King Kong, in that case.
And then it devolves into a big pool orgy.
Did you notice, speaking of orgies, sexual and all that, the statues are very, shall we say, generously proportioned. The men especially, but the women too.
Yeah, they're naked and they're hot. It's all about sex. I don't know, I wasn't around in 1975, but I imagine that this movie must have just felt like an absolute revolution when it comes to sex positivity.
I almost wish there had been more of it, though. The movie almost could have been weirder, because Frank does fuck Janet first and then Brad later, and that's supposed to be played for a laugh, but obviously Brad goes through with it. And there's no scene where he's running to the washroom and washing himself off like there is in Simpsons where Sideshow Bob fucks, was it Selma or Patty, whichever one it is. He seems to have gotten into it. So there almost should have been more sex than there even was, although I guess it's implied. You don't really see that much, although you do see some naked bodies. Well, then again, is it just the statues that are naked, or do we actually... We don't see Susan Sarandon, I don't think, per se,
do we? See Columbia kind of naked when she's wearing her bustier at the end. Her boobs are popping out, which was the costume detail. Just, I don't know, such a strange little thing that I found amazing. I loved that she just casually was doing this kind of nudity out of nowhere. So there was a song that was cut out, and it was Brad lamenting the fact that he had gone all the way with Frankenfurter. But as I understand, the song was more about his guilt that he was cheating on Janet over the infidelity. And then while Janet may have felt some guilt, she clearly didn't let it bother her for very long, because it's an hour later that she's doing it with Rocky in his little birth chamber and singing this Touch Me song, which is one of my favorite songs in the movie.
She's pretty into this whole experience. Do you think it's supposed to take place in the course of one day?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't really sure about that. It seemed like they maybe were there a lot longer than that. I guess it could be one of those dark and stormy night type movies in a castle, and at the end, the castle's not even existing anymore. It's gone off to another universe, or a galaxy, I guess. Okay, yeah, and these two are, if we didn't already say, fiancés. So they're cheating on each other, but they're both doing it, and they maybe are going to be better off for it. Maybe young people who've decided to get engaged and even to get married, we don't know for sure if these two have never had sex before. I'm not saying they should cheat on your partner, but maybe you should experiment a little more. You and I met in our later 30s, and that was probably for the best, because we had an awful lot of experiences before we ever actually were with each other. And I don't think it's better to just marry the first person you ever had sex with. Maybe it'll work for a lot of people, but I don't know about that.
And I think that the movie is using Brad and Janet to imply that there's a pervert in all of us, that if any of us were in the right time and place, we would surrender to lust, and there doesn't need to be anything wrong with that. Brad and Janet are still a couple at the end. I like to think that they still get married, and then they probably have an amazing sex life that they never would have had if they hadn't gotten that flat tire, if they haven't been lured into the castle. It's all part of the sex positivity. The thesis of the film is that everybody should loosen up and open their minds and get over themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what works about this movie. In some ways, I wish it had been more over the top than it was. But I wonder if maybe, much like Taxi Driver, which came a year later, it didn't want to go too far. Taxi Driver with racism. If you have too many black people getting murdered, then you're probably an X, or at least you're even more controversial and you cause more problems than it's really worth. In this movie, if you have too much sex and too much gay sex, too much pansexuality, because bisexuality is with a man or a woman, But pansexuality, as far as I understand it, is that you're really open.
Yeah, you can be attracted to any kind of person. You make it sound undiscerning. I don't think it's necessarily undiscerning when you're pansexual. Just more like man, woman, transgender. You're attracted to the person, and you can find yourself sexually attracted to any kind of person.
This may be surprising to our listeners, but I have no problem with that at all. If that's what you're into, then go with it.
You and I are pretty open-minded when it comes to this stuff, and I can't believe anybody gives a shit.
Our world would be so much better off if we would just get out of people's bedrooms and not dwell on things that are between consenting adults, because how is this ever going to be your business?
And why are you enforcing all these asinine, arbitrary rules on other people? What works for you works for you. I'm not going to try and step on anyone's relationship, even if it is really Puritan, fine. If that makes you happy, who am I? Why you care what goes on in other people's bedrooms? I don't know. Maybe part of the reason that it pulled some punches and didn't get really crazy is because it really hadn't been that long since censorship would have made a movie like this completely impossible. And a lot of the tongue-in-cheekness of some of the humor is a relic of the days when you couldn't speak anything queer aloud in a film. You can say easily in the 70s, of course it had opened up and there was a lot of heterosexual sex in 70s films, but it was still really hard to have a queer relationship that didn't end in some kind of punishment, whether they died or they ended up in a heteronormative relationship at the end.
We recently saw Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, a movie all about swinging, which I saw a long time ago, much like this, did not remember where it went or any of the beats really in it either. I'm the experienced one having seen it before, and I'm saying to you, okay, I don't remember when they actually do anything, but it takes forever for it to even start really even hinting at a swinging deal. And spoiler alert on a movie that's really old, they don't go through with it.
Yeah, it's a movie about swinging where nobody swings.
They don't fucking swing.
That's common with a lot of movies that cover swinging as a topic. They always seem to pull their punches, and they never have the couple or people go through with it. Occasionally they do.
A Swingers Weekend I saw not long ago. It's on demand right now, and there is some swinging in that, but not with the woman who actually organizes the whole thing. She doesn't get any out of it.
And it always comes with so much hand-wringing.
The Overnight is another movie. Adam Scott and Jason Schwartzman, and I forget the actresses right now, but they also pull their punches in that movie.
I'm sure that there are people out there that do that kind of stuff, and it's fine, and they don't wring their hands, and they have happy marriages, and they aren't punished in some way, and it's not such a big deal, but that is something that Hollywood is still puritanical about.
So even though this movie is probably pulling its punches, at least it has more balls than Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, The Overnight, or Swingers Weekend.
It's still hard to find a queer movie that isn't all about queerness. That can't just be a movie about a couple that happens to be queer or a person that happens to be gay or trans or whatever.
You loved The Weeknd, or not, sorry, The Weeknd, but just Weeknd from several years ago. Two guys. It's one of those slice of life type movies. Two English guys get together for a couple of days. They have a scene that's not in any way pornographic, but you know they fuck.
It's hot. But that movie's still very much about queerness. The character arc of one of the characters is to come to terms with the fact that he's gay and he's not closeted, but he's just not really living his full
gay life.
The other guy's more out.
So I'm tipping my hat to that one, is what I'm saying.
It's a beautiful movie that I cannot recommend highly enough. It's very much like Before Sunrise. It's so based on their conversations, but it's really beautifully written and performed and really rewatchable. And I feel like anybody could enjoy it, whether they think they would find something like that interesting or not. Even that seems to have to be about queerness. And I think real progress is going to be when you can just make any movie that you would normally make, but just replace the heterosexual couple with a queer couple and not make it a big deal. You're starting to see it happen a little bit, like how they've made Sulu gay in the Star Trek movies. Little things like that are starting to pop up where they're just making it not a big deal. It's in the background and nobody cares. Of course, people care. They're making a big deal about it, but it's time for that to become the norm.
It's funny, Rocky Horror is going on 45 years old next year, and it still stands out for going further than most movies do. Despite the fact we've said more than once that it probably doesn't go as far as it actually maybe should.
Going farther than movies that are made now about orgies, where literally you'll have orgy in the title and no orgy takes place in the movie.
Okay, well, the director, Jim Sharman, who is still alive, has only made 5 movies, and his last was Shock Treatment, so long ago. I didn't know if he's actually a Broadway guy, and he must be, or he just lives off the profits of Rocky Horror.
Like,
because,
God,
how can you make at least one movie in all that time? It's not like he was blackballed, I don't think. This was a fast shoot, and it does feel rushed, I think, a lot of the time. There's very little coverage. You talked about Susan Sarandon getting sick, and people had pneumonia. There was a really cold set. People were injured. And that's one of those things that happens, I guess, in a lower budget film, but it was Fox. It wasn't like it was an independent film. It was actually made by Fox. Sharman could have had a bigger budget if he was willing to cast popular musicians. So Meatloaf's in it, but he's the only one who's a popular rock star.
So if he had cast Mick Jagger like Mick Jagger wanted, maybe it would be a bigger budget film, but...
Wouldn't make it better, I don't think, though.
No way. You can't do better than Tim Curry as Frankenfurter.
Sharman and O'Brien were co-writers, and they do based on O'Brien's musical play. The producer, Michael White, did produce Monty Python and The Holy Grail this same year.
Wow. And
Shock Treatment.
Two cult films. Two films that are still so popular today.
The movie was on demand, so it was free. That's one of the reasons we haven't cut the cable. So many people we know have done that, but we still watch Jeopardy, which you can only really find on regular TV, regular cable, and also movies on demand. Recently, I watched The Thing and Jerry Maguire. We saw maybe 20 minutes of those. You went to bed and I thought, well, where's my DVD or Blu-ray? I'm popping that in and watch the rest of it.
TCM is great. We watch so many movies through TCM, and that's through the cable.
Right, and thanks for on demand. That's one of the reasons why we picked it, even though people suggested it. 25-1, the cinematographer Peter Sushitsky did Empire Strikes Back. We covered that quite a few years ago. And also, only a few months ago, A History of Violence. He is a Cronenberg guy in general. And the cutter Graham Clifford only cut 6 movies, including Don't Look Now, the horror film from only a few years before, the Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie movie. And then he became a director. And of course, the music is Richard O'Brien from his stage play. So what'd you think of the look and the cutting? And we already talked about the music being one of the best things in the whole film.
Speaking about the look specifically, it was incredibly influential. The designer has taken credit for introducing ripped fishnet stockings into punk couture. It was inspired by glam rock, but it went a long way to influence glam looks from here on out. I don't think you could possibly underestimate what an impact the look of this film had. And as far as the technicals, none of it is the greatest thing you've ever seen. It's a low-budget film, and they're just trying to slap it together, but it works with the theme, and it's an homage to these B films, and it adds to the tone because it's supposed to be super irreverent.
Didn't overstay its welcome either. It's only about 1 hour and 40 minutes, and that's more than long enough for a musical. We've covered plenty of musicals since the Top Runner Project when we had to cover things whether we wanted to or not, like American in Paris, although I love Singing in the Rain and Wizard of Oz. But we've covered since things like Hairspray, which I'm a big fan of, and I can't think of anything else, but I know we've covered a few musicals.
I can't either, goddammit. Cabaret, did you say that one?
That was on the original list, yeah. Okay, so the awards and list section, no Oscar nominations. It was inducted into the National Film Registry, so Congress is preserving this film. In 2005, along with Giant, The French Connection, and Toy Story, all movies we have covered on the Top 100 Project. Also that same year, Miracle on 34th Street, Cool Hand Luke, and The Sting. We've covered all of those as well since the Top 100 Project in the last couple of years. And Rocky Horror was nominated for the Top 100 Laughs. We chuckled and laughed here and there. It wasn't hilarious, but okay. Top 25 musicals. I wish in a way I'd made it, rather than all those ones that are from the 40s and the 50s, even the 30s. Have something more original and different on that list.
And it's a banger. The songs are amazing.
And then the top 100 songs with the Time Warp, which definitely should have been on there somewhere.
Robbery.
All right, so thanks to our listeners for suggesting this movie. More than one did. I'm glad you guys got to hear us talk about it. I hope you weren't disappointed by our podcast. But what are your last thoughts on Rocky Horror Picture Show? Tim Curry, Susan Sarandon, Barry Bostwick, Jim Sharman, Richard O'Brien. Kudos to all of you for making this weird, interesting movie that is pretty much one of a kind.
Yes, wonderfully so. It's a shame that I am old now and my bedtime is like 8:45 because I seriously feel like I've missed out by never attending a midnight screening and really experiencing the cult members of the most cult film ever. But the film stands up on its own. It's an alternative to nearly everything in dominant culture, but it's also a funny, fun satire. And like I said, I've been singing the songs all week to my pleasure.
I'd give it a thumb up, at the very least, for the originality, Curry's performance. Not really so much for Sarandon. Bostwick, actually, I think, is a little better than she is. Maybe because we knew what she was going to bring about. She was still pretty new on the scene. 6 years later, she's doing Atlantic City, or is it 5 years later? Anyway, with Burt Lancaster, gets nominated for that, and then she gets nominated year after year in the 90s and has done so many great movies. And she's not bad in this, and she looks great for sure. But we know she can do so much better than this.
It's funny to see her play someone innocent and guileless because that's not been her calling card since. Right.
Yeah, she's got a lot of sass and she's not a naif like she is in this movie. And by the way, her name's Susan Sarandon. She married Chris Sarandon, who was in Dog Day Afternoon this same year, 1975. Her actual maiden name is Susan Tomalin. So that's where the Sarandon comes from, is marrying him. Long divorced from him, though. Long before she even met Tim Robbins, and she's not even with him anymore. Okay, we're off again next week, like we were back in April for Easter, right? And this time to enjoy fireworks on Victoria Day. Victoria Day. I'm glad to have the day off, but what a stupid holiday. When we return on May, when we return on May 27th, it'll be Memorial Day in America, and we'll get down with a war flick starring a bunch of noble black men and their white savior, Matthew Broderick, in glory.
The movie most of you probably had to watch in a history classroom at one point in your life.
So my coming attractions trivia for Glory in 2 weeks. 12 people, a dozen, both men and women, have won Oscars in leading performances and also supporting performances. 7 of them won their supporting Oscar award before they won in a leading role. Denzel Washington in Glory is one of them, because he won for Training Day after he won for Glory. Name the other 6.
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Glory. But what if you just can't wait until then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com, where you can find lots of great stuff. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, and you can find us on Spotify now, too. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered almost 300 movies now, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, and while you're there, you can give us a rating and a review. That means a lot to us. And as per this episode, if there is a movie that you would like to hear us talk about, and you happen to mention it in a review, well then we will seriously consider doing it. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. We really love hearing from you guys. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. That's all one word, top100project. And it is not case sensitive.
You mentioned 300 episodes, and that is very soon. That'll be in June. Although on this channel, there are a lot more than 300 because of scoring at the movies and because of other things. But anyway, we've talked about that before. We should never have numbered this podcast. That was a mistake. But 300 episodes with you and I is not too far away now. As far as a parting shot from Rocky Horror, let's do the time warp again. Let's just say it, not even sing it. Let's do the time warp again.
Right. I'll take a step to the left. And cut.
Put your hands on your hips.